Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
So we have about 35,000 squirrels here in the collection.
And 35,000 squirrels are just the tiniest tip of the iceberg. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. Imagine you had to make a gigantic time capsule of life on Earth. What would you put in it? How would you choose? 35,000 squirrels? Every single mammal that's ever existed? Fossils, bones, stones, gems? Sounds like a crazy question, right? But I am in such a time capsule right now. It's called a natural history museum. More specifically, I'm in Washington, D.C. at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. These places tell the story of our planet, our story. They advance science. They have inspired generations of scientists and created aha moments for all of us.
I always take something new from my experience every time I come here.
I love bats. Bats are nuts.
From the beginning of existence to this giant squid, I mean, you can see anything and everything.
Yeah, there's a really big buck back there. That's really cool.
But at a time where anything we ever wanted to know or see is just one click away, how are these aging institutions staying relevant? What is their role? What is their future? We're going to answer some of these questions on today's show. And right now, I'm looking at a gigantic taxidermied elephant. He's called Henry, in the rotunda of the Smithsonian. And I can go a bunch of different ways here. I can go to geology, gems, and minerals. I could check out the mammals, the ocean section. And that got me wondering about how these categories are chosen. I thought the best person to answer that would be the director of this place. His name is Kirk Johnson. Let's go up to his office.
Oh, back in. Oh, wow.
I love it.
Just think for a moment about planet Earth. It's a rock ball covered with living things. Anything on that rock ball, including the rock ball itself, and all those living things, and all the people that ever lived there, are fair game for this museum. We do preserve the totality of life on planet Earth and planet Earth itself. So whether it's an insect or an archaeological site or a meteorite or a piece of iron ore, a gold nugget, or a giant dinosaur skeleton, or a pickled whale, or a frozen porpoise, that's all part of this collection.
And the Hope Diamond?
Of course, the Hope Diamond.
Why the Hope Diamond?
We know it's interesting because when people, when they come into this museum, they say, and we ask them, what are you going to see? They'll say, well, we're going to see the Hope Diamond, and they can't name the second thing. They might say dinosaurs or mummies, but they don't say a certain dinosaur or a certain mummy. They can name the Hope Diamond. That's an icon. And for whatever reason, this little diamond, it's only 44 carats, which was mailed to us in a cardboard box in the late 50s, has become an icon. It has an amazing history. It dates way back, you know, its formation in the earth, but then it was owned by kings and eventually came to the possession of a New York jeweler who mailed it to us. It's got a cool story. It's an icon. And certain objects are iconic, and the Hope Diamond is our iconic object.
So iconic status gets you fast-tracked into the exhibit hall. And Kirk Johnson of the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History also said everything on this rock ball Earth is fair game to be in the museum. But of course, when you have almost 150 million items in your possession, there has to be some serious editing going on in terms of what is displayed. And visitors have certain expectations. We like mummies because they're so cool. Dinosaurs because they have a major wow factor. And sure, they are all part of our planet's story. But are we as visitors aware that we're only seeing a fraction of this big story? Should the selection process somehow be more transparent? Reporter Irina Zhorov now takes us to Pittsburgh, where one tiny museum is challenging the big natural history institutions to have a conversation about what exactly natural means.
In a business district east of Pittsburgh's downtown, between a pizza shop and a Vietnamese restaurant is an easy-to-miss storefront.
Welcome to the Center for Postnatural History.
Richard Pell is the curator of the small museum. He's 40 but looks younger, informal in a pair of shorts, perpetually smiling sneakily. His museum is a collection of specimens, everything from seeds to mammals, that have been shaped by humans. Standing by him in the entryway, for example, is a genetically engineered goat designed to produce industrial spider silk in its milk. He motions past it.
So it go past the curtain into the permanent collection here?
The exhibition room is dimly lit, kind of mysterious. We pause at a case where Pell shows off an English bulldog skull. Descended from wolves thousands of years ago, they've been bred by people to accentuate their punched-in noses, but now the animals can barely breathe. Across the room, illuminated display boxes built into black walls shine like gems. In one of them, standing upright, is a white rat. This rat is a perfect case study to better understand the story Pell wants to tell in his museum.
This is an alcoholic laboratory rat that was bred by the Finnish government.
Alcoholism is a big public health problem in Finland, so scientists bred the rat to study the disease. But to get to this point in its breeding evolution, we have to go back more than 100 years.
The first time that human beings that we know of bred rats in captivity was in London and New York in the late 18th, early 19th century for a sport, a blood sport, called rat baiting.
Those cities suffered from rat infestations. People would gather 100 rats, throw them in a pen with a dog, and bet on how long it took the dog to kill all the rats.
This is like something that guys would do over, you know, cigars and beer or whatever.
If you saw the movie Gangs of New York, you might remember the scene with a crowd of top hat wearing men cheering on a terrier.
Gentlemen! The match is due to commence! The count to beat is 25 rodents in 3 minutes!
Some rat catchers started setting aside interesting-looking rats to breed. That's when you start seeing recessive gene albino rats, like the one in the case. Those white rats were separated out and begat more of the same.
And those white rats have a different cultural meaning than the dirty-looking street rats. And so they get treated differently. Maybe they come home. They become the pets. They become the fancy rats that get bred throughout the rest of the 19th century, largely by women.
Aristocratic Victorian women in England adorned their rats with ribbons and socialized with them, but they also started breeding the rats for specific traits. And those rats are the ones that get used for lab work. In other words, the road to the Finnish alcoholic rat was a winding one.
Our story just went from blood sports to hobbyists to geneticists, all within the same lineage. And that's what postnatural history is.
He defines postnatural organisms as ones that have been altered by people intentionally and heritably.
Heritably meaning we've altered its evolutionary path in some fashion. It affects its offspring. It's not just a dog with a weird haircut. It's we've bred dogs that have weird hair. And intentional in that it reflects our culture in some way. They reflect what we want, what we fear, what we desire.
All of the specimens in Pell's museum have similarly complex biographies. They started out as wild animals, and for whatever reason, food, research, productivity, aesthetics, humans have modified them to fit their needs.
There are no universal stories. They're all very specifically tied to the people who make them.
Pell took on the job of telling these post-natural stories when he realized that natural history museums weren't doing it. Curators viewed such specimens as boring, or they didn't fit ideas of natural history in the culture of the 19th and 20th century, when the museums were being built. Stephen Tonser, director of science and research at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History, says the museums drew a line between humans and animals that's not really there. A typical natural history museum, he says,
tells a story that's really very much woven up in the Judeo-Christian notion of humans as separate from the rest of the living world. And it sets up a story of self versus other. We often hear the phrase man versus nature.
Sarah Ray, who studies museums at the University of Pennsylvania, agrees. She says curators have historically decided what got in displays and what got left out.
What you have is people making a decision about what was natural, what was nature, that was very intentional, or it's very infused with like the human idea of what is natural. And it really kind of implicitly takes out all of the human influence that you find in the natural habitats of these animals.
Natural history, then, was something pure, non-human. It was buffalo grazing on pristine prairie, not buffalo being hunted by Native Americans or raised for meat. It was something other. So the good stuff wasn't on the farm. You had to travel for it. No wonder cows and dogs didn't show up in the dioramas much. They didn't fit those mores. And those standards are still not regularly questioned.
When you're a kid and you walk into a museum in natural history, you're like, oh, that's geology and that's, you know, Asian mammals. Or, you know, what you just sort of take for granted the categories that are there and the information that you're being given as just sort of being this objective scientific entity that exists sort of outside of yourself.
I asked Pell to show me around the Carnegie Museum of Natural History, across town from his own in Pittsburgh, to see just how few post-natural specimens make it into displays.
One more floor. I think we'll start in Egypt, actually. We'll do it chronologically. Okay.
In the Egypt room, an archaeological human-focused exhibit, behind glass, Pell points to a 4,000-year-old mummified bundle that has been x-rayed to reveal a cat inside.
That is an old cat. I don't know, in cat years, I'm not even sure what that's going to come to.
Next, we walk over to a wing dedicated to Arctic polar people and look at a couple of black taxidermied sled dogs mounted in 1896. Carnegie's Stephen Tonser had joined us.
Contact with Arctic peoples was much more limited, so these were exotic, right? But now you can find Siberian huskies or various other Arctic breeds of dogs generally bred and available. They're not exotic anymore.
That could be why the Field Museum in Chicago donated these dogs to the Carnegie Museum in 1984. Finally, we make our way to the bird hall. The birds are arranged by habitat and specific traits. And then there's this one case that stands out.
It's sort of birds that exist within popular culture. So you've got Tweety Bird from Warner Brothers alongside an actual yellow canary. We have Foghorn Leghorn, who's a chicken, and there's kind of an empty space next to it.
It's empty because the museum couldn't find a chicken in its collection to put there. An extinct dodo bird? No problem. But a chicken? Nope.
So in terms of domesticated taxidermy on display in the museum, I've been looking, and that could be it.
Pell seems delighted to have caught the museum with its millions of specimens in this funny position. No chicken. For him, including a chicken and all those other post-natural organisms he keeps at his museum would make for a more realistic representation of our world. And it doesn't have to be boring. If told well, he says, their stories, just like the lab rats, would be as compelling as the, quote, exotic animals. Standing by a polar bear and a dated map of the polar ice cap, Tonser and Pell start to talk about the importance of thinking more holistically. They mostly agree that, historically, museums have done a poor job of showing the interconnectedness of humans and the natural world.
It's the problem with the categories is what we're calling attention to. Because we systematically edit ourselves out of the story. Science does this all the time. You're doing a field study, but you don't acknowledge the people that are there. You take your pictures, but you try to get out of the shot.
Right.
What we're doing is just advocating for a wider lens, one that just takes full account of the people that are involved and their stories, their motivations, the contradictions.
We've treated science as something that we can separate from the rest of human existence. And we've treated, in fact, the world as a giant machine in which we can isolate parts and manipulate those parts, when, in fact, everything is interconnected. And the unintended consequences of our really powerful and in many ways beneficial scientific advances are now being seen on a global scale.
Tonser is talking about climate change, species extinction, big changes in the, quote, natural world. His museum, the Carnegie, is starting to rethink how to incorporate humans into the exhibits, to start to tell a different story. One that's not so clean.
I'm looking for people to take responsibility for the great power that they've taken on.
Irina Zhuroff reporting from Pittsburgh. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Today, we're at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. And when you walk around in this place, take it all in, the gems, giraffes, the butterflies, a big part of the experience can be boiled down to how specimens are displayed, the drama created around them, just the right combination of information, lighting, color, and special effects. I talked about exhibit design with Kara Blonde. She is director of exhibitions at the Smithsonian, and Mike Lawrence. He's the chief designer. And I asked Mike how he draws attention to objects that don't have a huge wow factor. So, for example, if you have a mealworm and you want people to look at it, but everybody wants to see the dinosaur.
Well, that's a good question. You don't put a mealworm too close to a dinosaur because you got to keep all the photo ops there in front of it. But I think it kind of goes back to sort of the scale and the context in which it's displayed. If you can show how a parasite of some sort, you know, like a boar beetle that can bring down a whole forest, it's that scale. So you think, okay, this little critter can destroy this whole side of a mountaintop of cedars or firs or whatever it is. So immediately you play on that scale, right? So you'd want to have a huge photo mural of the context, and then that tiny little beetle under a tiny little intensive light, right, so that people could see that connection. So sometimes you have to take something that's small or insignificant looking, and by creating the context, help direct people's attention to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes it's the hidden sort of secret moments that are most compelling to visitors when they come. You know, it's the little video inside the termite mound in our insect zoo that only the like tiniest of kid is going to be able to crawl through to get to see. And I think that's just as special as the mass T-Rex selfies in the middle of our biggest galleries.
Should we go out into the exhibit halls?
Sure.
We've walked over to the Hall of Mammals now, and the way this is designed is very striking. I'm looking at these huge glass cases that are just filled with mammals, but the mammals are on shelves. It looks a little bit like we're at IKEA in a strange way. And in front of me is a moose, and then next to the moose is a very small Chinese water deer. Next to that is a European mole, and then there is a rhinoceros. So it is really just this wild display of different mammals. Now, Mike and Kara, this was designed before you guys came to the Smithsonian, but what is the thinking here? Why this look?
Well, I think some of it really is about just the wacky wildness of mammals, showing from the biggest to the smallest, from the most familiar to the least familiar.
So I think here we really wanted to focus on the physicality of the mammals, to be able to see them for what they were, to see the great contrast in scale, like this great rhino here against the tiny little rodents next to it, to have a clear view so that a child in a stroller can point up to something as well as an adult.
Do you have a favorite mammal in here?
I'm a walrus girl. I just love the walrus. And to get up close to it, we actually did a big cleaning day as a whole department. And I got in there and cleaned his tusks and like brushed his fur with a tiny little brush. And it's just amazing. I know he's dead, but he's just so grand.
Kara Blonde is the director of exhibitions at the Smithsonian Natural History Museum, and Mike Lawrence, the chief designer. And when you look around in the Hall of Mammals here at the Smithsonian, there are no dioramas. That's weird, right? When you go to a natural history museum, you want to see dioramas. But the way specimens are displayed in these places has changed over time. There are different approaches. Paige Flager is now going to take us to the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, where she is staring a puma in the eye.
Crouching high up on a boulder, the puma is ready to pounce. It's stalking four deer below it on the forest floor.
You can tell that they can kind of sense that something's wrong. They look alert. They're looking at the visitors. And you know that what's about to happen next is that the puma is going to attack the mule deers. And there's this whole story caught in this one moment. And, you know, when I look at it, I just don't know who to root for. You know, I want to tell the mule deer, run away. But look at this beautiful cat who needs to eat and might have cubs or... And that's the story of nature right there.
Jennifer Sanchi is the Senior Director of Exhibits and Public Spaces at the museum. We're in the North American Hall, and it looks exactly how you'd picture a natural history museum from your childhood, no matter what era your childhood was in. And that's because most of these elaborate displays were constructed back in the 1930s. But when natural history museums first opened half a century earlier, they were basically just a hodgepodge of animal specimens. Karen Rader is the co-author of a book called Life on Display, Revolutionizing U.S. Museums of Science and Natural History in the 20th Century.
So there was an ornithologist at the Smithsonian that described the first displays as, quote, a perfect chaos.
By perfect chaos, she means the original displays kind of looked like somebody went hunting around the world and then tossed all the taxidermied carcasses together in glass cases. Then in the 1880s, these museums started to think of themselves as public educators. They put the majority of their collections behind the scenes for the scientists, and only their best critters in glass cases for the visitors. And instead of crazy Latin names, signs had common names that people recognized and could pronounce. Instead of Cyanocytocristata, for example, it would just say Blue Jay.
That was sort of the first toe in the water of making these displays more accessible. And as time went on, the displays responded more and more to other cultural trends.
Cultural trends like window shopping and fancy department store displays.
This became more of a tradition within the museum as well. And the rationale for this was that if folks are seeing in consumer culture very attractive things that they want to look at, why shouldn't the same strategy be used to harness their interest for education?
These displays were aesthetically pleasing, but they lacked context. Scientists started to push for a more ecological approach, and that's where the dioramas came in. Researchers and artists went into the field, picked a specific location, and then recreated that location perfectly and meticulously, down to each individual blade of grass. And people went wild for these new displays. Pun intended.
And we know this because if you look in newspapers, they'll talk about attendance going up, you know, tremendous attendance at the American Museum of Natural History reported in the New York Times when there's a new diorama.
And because of all of that attention, there was a lot of competition amongst these museums, which sometimes led them off the righteous path of scientific accuracy. That's what happened with the Academy of Natural Sciences moose, Jennifer Sanchi says.
The wonderful, you know, Academy story of this moose diorama is that the director at the time looked at the moose and the diorama as it was getting put together and said, you know, I'm pretty sure that these antlers aren't quite as big as the American Museum of Natural History's antlers. I want bigger antlers. And so they went back into the field, got a bigger moose, removed his antlers and put them on our moose. So I find this to be absolutely hilarious because we have a Frankenmoose.
And nearly a century later, Frankenmoose is still there in the hall, unchanged, despite all of the time that's passed. Sanchi says that there are some people in her field who think that these dioramas may seem dusty and outdated. Some of them haven't even been opened since the glass was sealed into place when they were created decades ago. A lot of dioramas fall into a state of disrepair because of the hefty price tag associated with sprucing them up. Plus, there's a fair amount of pressure on natural history museum curators and designers to keep exhibits up to date and relevant. A vacuum-sealed slice of life from the 1930s may not totally fit into that vision.
At the American Museum of Natural History, we're kind of a museum of museum displays.
The American Museum is in New York City, and David Harvey is the Senior Vice President for Exhibition. The place is perhaps best known for their North American Mammal Hall. It's full of these huge, beautiful dioramas that seem, ironically, really full of life. In one display, a spotted skunk does a headstand to ward off a predator. In another, a pack of wolves chase after a deer in a snowy field.
It is really thought of as the Sistine Chapel of dioramas, diorama halls.
Imagine, then, what would happen if the Sistine Chapel decided to just scrap Michelangelo's paintings on the ceiling. Attendance would probably drop drastically. So, the American Natural History Museum shelled out the money to have their dioramas restored. Harvey says that in their temporary exhibits, they're experimenting with more modern takes on these classic dioramas. And one of the ways that he plans to do that is pretty simple. Get rid of the glass.
Obviously, as we move into the 21st century, the trend with dioramas really is inclusionary. It is really about bringing the diorama around the visitor, bringing the visitor into the diorama.
Harvey hopes that that will make the museum look and feel more modern while still catering to the nostalgia that people have for the dioramas. Back in Philadelphia at the Academy of Natural Sciences, a little boy drags his parents over to the diorama of the puma about to pounce on the deer. Do you see this? Do you see what he's about to do? He asks his parents as he points his small finger up at the puma. He's going to kiss them, his mom suggests. They're playing peekaboo, the dad says.
No.
No, the boy responds. He's going to kill them. He laughs and runs to the next window, looking up at a giant polar bear. Even without the bells and whistles, the dioramas still have a bit of magic left in them. For The Pulse, I'm Paige Flager.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about natural history museums today, and we're at the Smithsonian in Washington. Keeping your exhibit halls looking fresh and appealing is just one aspect of larger challenges that these museums face. In an age where people have so many options, where all of us travel a lot and we can go online and we go to movies and watch television so we can see anything we want at any time, how do these places stay relevant? And how do they bring attention to all of the interesting work that happens behind the scenes? Here's some more of my conversation with Kirk Johnson. He is the director here at the Smithsonian.
I think a lot about the future of natural history museums, and I think about them because these museums are largely a creation of the 19th century. And they were built during a time when people were realizing, hey, there's amazing stuff out there, but I live in a city. I want to see that stuff. So people would bring animals to a museum and build dioramas. They'd build a reconstruction of a landscape in a building in a city so the people in the city could see what it was like to be out looking at lions, for instance. That was before we had television, before you could do travel and tours and stuff like that. So now you think, well, do we still need museums? And it turns out that a lot of those places we built as dioramas don't exist anymore. The museum I used to work at in Denver, its first collection item was the last wild-caught bison in Colorado. They shot the last bison in the state and put it in the museum because they knew the bison were going away. So they figured, well, let's get the last one. And we'll preserve a memory that there were bison once in Colorado. And museums in some way were acting like memories. The place is changing. Here's the memory of what it used to be like. And if you think about it that way, your own memory is really important to you. Your own family is very important to you. Museums are the memory of our culture. They actually help you understand where we came from and what's changed as we've evolved in our culture to be what we are today. So when I think about the future of natural history museums, I am alert to the fact that I am running an organization that was founded in the 1840s. It's a long time ago. Most organizations founded in the 1840s aren't in business anymore. And those kinds of disruptions that change the businesses have yet to change museums because we remain the one place that is the memory of our culture. The objects we hold on the behalf of the people of this nation are objects that are not held by anybody else.
What are some of the challenges that this place faces and perhaps all of the natural history museums?
You know, the big challenge for natural history museums is they're perceived as old, dusty places where nothing happens. And we've done a poor job of communicating that we're not places about the past that are dusty, but we are in fact places that are about the future and exciting. And when you spend just a little bit of time here and you meet the scientists who are making discoveries all around the world, you cannot believe how exciting this place is. I mean, it's a remarkable spot, but in many cities, the natural history museums are going out of business or they are losing their scientists because they become places where people think, well, this is where we take the kids. We'll entertain the kids at the natural history museum because they like dinosaurs. And they don't see past the dinosaurs, they don't see the future of the planet, and they don't see the collections. So I think our big challenge in natural history museums is to share what we know, which is this is the place that is the planet's memory, and it has a lot to say about the planet's future. If you care about being a human or about the future, natural history museums are part of the solution.
Kirk Johnson directs the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, and he just said that these institutions are preserving the memory of our culture. Usually, that means the memory of things, of animals that are no longer here on this planet. Now, let's take a trip to one museum that is preserving a 65-acre forest as part of its collections, the Fernbank Natural History Museum in Atlanta. Now, preserving a forest sounds like it shouldn't be so difficult, right? Sunlight, rain, let nature do its thing. But it turns out taking care of this unique exhibit means defending it from the very species meant to enjoy it. Reporter Stephanie Stokes has more.
I start at the edge of the Fernbank Forest with museum ecologist Eli Dickerson.
So I was thinking we could sort of follow the creek into the heart of the forest. There's a nice loop we can do around there.
Dickerson's bearded, hiker-looking. He shows me how these 65 acres of old-growth forest are like one big exhibit into how this region looked long before European settlers arrived. We look up at the thick tree canopy stretching 156 feet in the air.
Pretty tall. It's about a 16-story building.
We check out the forest floor, filled with dozens of native plants.
Just in front of us here, I see seedlings of beech trees, seedlings of sweet gum.
Then we go even lower. Dickerson bends down next to an interactive part of the exhibit, a series of little doors built into a hill. He opens one, and we see the natural dark topsoil that helps plants grow.
This deep topsoil tells us something about people and the history of people in Fernbank Forest. This was never extensively logged or farmed.
In most places, that kind of human activity has washed the natural topsoil away. But while this lush forest may have never been cut down by people, it's hardly remained untouched. Dickerson takes me to a pond with a slope on the opposite side.
This is part of our namesake. This is what we refer to as the Fernbank Slope.
Once it was filled with different species of native ferns. But now we're looking at a hill that's mostly brown with just a little green.
So this mosaic that you see on the hillside, everywhere that is brown used to be solid green with English ivy.
An invasive introduced by people over 100 years ago. At Fernbank, it's crowded out at least a dozen native plants. The museum is fighting back. Dickerson leads volunteers and staff in ridding the forest of these familiar enemies, English ivy and also microstegium and monkey grass. And that makes this collection different from other museum artifacts. To protect the ancient forest, they can't simply let it be.
If I was to stop all of those ecological restoration activities within a few months to a few years, we would see English ivy crawling back up the trunks of the trees into the crowns. Eventually, the trees would die. It would completely cover the forest floor. So that would have a ripple effect.
And Dickerson worries that keeping invasive plants at bay may become even more difficult with a warming climate. A whole new array of these species from farther south could find their way into the forest. Still, he isn't deterred. He sees his work as more than just a daunting gardening project.
Although at face value, you might say, well, this looks like the forest in my backyard or down the street. I think there's a different feeling here. You know, you kind of slow down and think about everything that has happened here in this forest over the years and centuries and millennia.
After wandering a bit, Dickerson and I reach the edge of the woods again, and we say our goodbyes. Dickerson's excited to get back to work in the forest. He says he always is. For The Pulse, I'm Stephanie Stokes.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Our show today is about natural history museums, their role, their future. We're at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., and I took a tour of the Human Origins Hall. It tells the story of how us humans entered the picture here on planet Earth. And more than that, it attempts to examine what makes us human beyond walking upright and small eye teeth. To illustrate that, the director of the exhibit, Rick Potts, took me to a display case which holds over 75 skulls. They represent our evolutionary cousins going back 6 million years, and he pointed to one specific skull.
We call it the old timer on the display here. It's an individual, and we have much of the skeleton of this individual from a site in the Republic of Georgia. Right at the gate between Asia and Europe. We call it the old timer because he was an elderly male. And as you look at the skull, and you can also see this in the lower jaw as well, is that he had no teeth. His teeth had fallen out. And any dentist or forensic scientist would look at that skull and say that, well, this individual actually didn't have any teeth for probably about the last 5 to 8 years of his life. There's that much bone around the jaw that has become resorbed or disappearing before the individual died. And so what does that mean? It meant for that period of time, someone fed him. Members of his social group cared for him. He couldn't go out. His skeleton was so decrepit. He probably just sat out in a cave or out in the open air. And members of his social group cared for him. Well, this skull is almost 2 million years old. And who would think that the human ability to care for one another at that level would go back that far in time?
Rick Potts directs the Human Origins Program at the Smithsonian. He spends a lot of time looking at ancient skulls, ancient bones, and sometimes when researchers do that, when they examine hundreds and hundreds of specimens, they notice something, a change, a new development. Let's now head to the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology in Philadelphia, where one passionate researcher found a clue as to why so many people today have crooked teeth. Here's Tanya English.
I met Janet Monge in her lab. It's a comfortable jumble of artifacts and papers.
It is what it is. I mean, like, you know, the thing is, I'm not going to make it look like someplace that nobody works. It just is what it is. It's also loved.
The anthropologist has thick eyebrows and wears her glasses on a beaded string. When I arrive, the glasses are perched on her head, and Monge is in front of a collection of about 20 different skulls. The bones are creamy white, brown, and yellow. One from ancient Peru, another is from Philadelphia in the 1800s.
Some of them are archaeological, so they could be a few thousand years old to a few hundred years old.
Monge's title is Keeper and Curator. Her team of bone and tooth experts use super-powered imaging scanners and an electron microscope that can show a sliver of hard tissue at 40,000 times its actual size. There are lots of reasons to study the bones of ancient people.
You can talk about their teeth or how they locomoted or whatever, and obviously lots of people do that, or the shape of their head and how many muscles are on this place or that place. A person like Janet Monge doesn't give a damn. I really kind of want to know when they become humans.
Her interest is how children become social, how they learn to share or cooperate, for example. And Monge says teeth can tell part of that story, and along the way, she and colleagues in the field notice something.
This is the amazing part that nobody's ever been able to figure out. Nobody in the past had dental problems. Like, we are talking nobody.
She's not talking about cavities. Monge wants to show me how straight teeth used to be. For the proof, she sends an intern to find a specimen from a dig site in Iran.
Go into, this is actually in a cabinet in the mummy room, that yellow cabinet that's in there.
Okay.
So find the lower jaw of 75-29-5-43.
Monge has been doing this work since the 1970s, and decades later, she's still delighted by a good find.
And that's beautiful. Okay. Actually, we're looking at a skull that he has in his hand. Okay. So
the skull is from a person who lived maybe 5,000 years ago.
Those teeth are beautiful teeth.
Yeah.
And yet, it has a Hollywood smile. Straight, white, symmetrical. two little rectangles in the front, long eye teeth on the sides, and wisdom teeth sitting pretty in the back.
It's like the upper jaw, the maxilla, and the lower jaw, the mandible, are in actually kind of perfect unity with each other. And the interesting thing is that that was everybody in human history.
But we lost that, and we lost it fast. Monge says today crooked teeth are epidemic. She's studied skulls across the ages and has pinpointed the emergence of crooked smiles.
So what happens 150 years ago that changes that? I mean, something significant happens, and it's almost global.
What happened? The Industrial Revolution happened. That's the period when a culture shifts from an agrarian rural life to manufacturing jobs in the city. So here's the hypothesis. Crooked teeth don't just come from genes. That's nature. Crooked teeth are largely created by nurture, our environment and habits after we're born. Anthropologist Janet Monge says as women went off to factories, they couldn't take their babies with them, and many mothers nursed for a much shorter time. Eons before that, moms carried their babies with them everywhere, and they commonly breastfed until a child was age 3 or 4. By the mid-1800s, there were many more bottle-fed babies, and the way an infant sucks from a bottle is very different from how she feeds at the breast.
It's even proper tongue position, which is high up in the palate, which actually pushes on the beginning front teeth.
Breastfed infants have to work hard to get milk, and that muscle training shapes the growth and development of the face. As those babies eat, with every pull, they create a wide, more projected jawbone. On the other hand, Monge says an offset jaw, like a rickety house foundation, sets the trajectory for adult teeth that can come in crooked later.
I mean, it's basically like, we have artificially created the weak face.
Mouths are more narrow now, Monge says, but we have the same number of teeth as always. So the idea goes that causes crowding and overbite, snaggle teeth, or wisdom teeth that have no room to grow in. Crooked teeth can make it difficult to chew, misaligned teeth are harder to keep clean, and protruding lower teeth rub against and wear down teeth on the top. And that sends lots of us to the orthodontist.
Tanya English reporting from the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology in Philadelphia. I'm at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. today, and this place has close to 150 million specimens. Just let that sink in for a second. Director Kirk Johnson said, what we see in the exhibit halls here is just the tip of the iceberg.
You can't put everything on display because there's so many things. And so one of the great ironies and the great sadnesses of natural history museums is that most people don't know that there's a rest of the iceberg. The behind-the-scenes stuff is so cool, and people don't know about it. They don't know we have collections. They don't know we have scientists.
So how do you bring the excitement of what happens behind the scenes out into the world? One museum has found a way with a wildly popular video series called The Brain Scoop. It's hosted by Emily Grassley. Our own wildly popular reporter, Todd Bookman, has this profile.
Emily Grassley didn't grow up a museum kid. Her family never went to see stuffed polar bears or T-Rex bones.
We didn't. I mean, I grew up in South Dakota. The closest thing that I had to a natural history museum in terms of like taxidermied animals or dioramas or whatever was like your local hunting store.
But while studying art at the University of Montana, Grassley came across the school's underfunded but really diverse natural history collection. And she fell in love.
And so from artistic perspective, I became really interested in the specimens in the collection and started drawing them and painting them and trying to get my art friends to come over and create artwork based off the collection. And that gradually developed into photography and then blogging and then my web series.
That web series, The Brain Scoop, is now more than 140 episodes deep.
Welcome to my 350 million year old carboniferous forest.
In it, Grassley, who's 27, explores what happens behind the scenes at natural history museums, first in Montana and now at the Field Museum in Chicago, where she holds the title Chief Curiosity Correspondent. She produces short videos showcasing a strange species of fish or Amazonian tree, and all the research and work that goes into the exhibits. In this older episode, she's out in the field trying to find a bear carcass.
In the middle of the road?
It's right here.
Could it be
there it
right
is.
Here?
Yep, that's it.
Found it! Found it!
It's like Easter Sunday.
There should be more than...
Grassley brings the bones back to the lab, where she walks the audience through how they get cleaned and prepped for study or presentation. In fact, there are lots of bones and blood and guts on the brain scoop. None of it censored.
Woo, there we go. It's throat. We just cut through the throat. This is all cartilage, and you can see bile. There's a little bit of bile matter in there.
She's gutting a wolf, and more than once nearly throws up during the process. But she doesn't quit or stop trying to educate.
Why do we demonize this kind of thing? Why do we call it gross? It's not gross, it's biology. And so I kind of dismissed that mentality that this was gross or wrong or bad in some kind of way and started trying to encourage other people to open their minds a little bit and think about the wonder and the beauty and the unlikelihood of natural life.
That sense of wonder has earned Grassley a huge legion of fans. Her videos get hundreds of thousands of views and receive high marks from big names in the field of science, including this guy.
I'm Robert Krolwich, and I'm a co-host of Radiolab.
Yeah, Robert Krolwich of that Radiolab. He's written about Grassley in the past. And so when I reached out for a comment, he dropped what he was doing and called me up on Labor Day in his free time to sing her praises.
She puts the whole sloppy business of learning right in front of you. She gets things wrong. She gets things right by mistake. She gasps. She's surprised. She's overwhelmed. She's underwhelmed. And you see a person actually learning. And there's something very viral and contagious about that. A, because it's rare, and most important, because it's real.
Grassley's authenticity comes through, and she's clearly comfortable being the star. But her job is also to bring out the best in the researchers she has on. Researchers who aren't always skilled at explaining their work or comfortable on camera.
Well, yeah, it all comes down to, like, you know, video work and communication is hard work. It's, they don't come to me really judgmental about how little I know about science, right? And so it's unfair for me to go to them and say, you're not naturally gifted as a communicator, so I'm not going to take the time to work with you.
Instead, they together reveal strange histories and facts about the objects in the collection. Her greatest strength, though, what makes the Brain Scoop just so watchable, is how funny Grassley can be, cracking jokes during dissections.
Oh, God, that reeks. Ugh. Let's try to describe that smell. What does it smell like? It smells like KFC if you leave it in the back of your car with a layer of water at the bottom of the bucket in 100-degree weather for 8 years. I would say that humor plays a huge role in what we're doing and why it's successful, because, like, you always get this question, does it have to be entertaining or educational? And my answer is always, why can't it be both?
It is both, but the Brain Scoop is also a third thing, which is simply good marketing for the Field Museum. It's the type of outreach initiative other institutions would be wise to attempt. Grassley is also a vocal champion of women in the STEM fields, and she hopes an inspiration for younger viewers to take up the sciences.
You know, maybe somebody watches our content and they're like, I didn't know that you could get a job studying millipedes.
Millipedes, dead wolves, whatever. Grassley is trying to open the door to all of the natural world, even the messy parts. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
That's our show for this week, much of which was recorded at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. A very big thank you to everybody there, and especially Randall Kramer, who hosted us. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, Todd Bookman, and Irina Zhorov. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Joel Patterson, the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Now I'm the king of the swingers, oh, the jungle VIP. I've reached the top and had to stop, and that's what's bothering me. I want to be a man cub, and stroll right into town and be just like the other men. I'm tired of mugging around. Oh, ooby-doo, I want to be like you. I want to walk like you, chip, talk like you, chip, too. You see it's true. Shoo-bidi-doo. An ape like me,
Scooby-Dooby-Dooby,
can learn to be human too.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.